Got a little announcement. There we go. There we go. Well, slightly earlier opening of the bar today, Paul.
Very early, Jeff.
It's not very early.
Well, I feel guilty from
Do you?
I do feel the look I got from my wife when I took a can of cider out of the fridge at
But
3 o'clock.
technically, we're in the Netherlands today.
We're on European time. Can we
We're on
say that? Yeah,
European
we
time, yeah.
yeah.
So this is, it's almost 5 o'clock. If we're round,
Almost, yeah.
if we're rounding up, it's 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
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 So
The sun is past the yardarm, as they say.
the So yeah, we've got two guests with us today in the Netherlands. Are you both in the same part of the Netherlands, Barry, Christian?
Roughly.
Yeah,
Christian
we're
lives in the city, Utrecht, and I live in the Provence, Utrecht. So it's close enough. It's
okay.
only a 30-minute drive between us.
Cool. So yeah, Barry Overeem, have I pronounced that right?
Yeah,
And Christian Verwijs.
perfect,
Very good,
perfect.
Jeff. Very
Okay.
good. Very good.
You're
Yeah.
very Dutch, that's good.
Well, I do practice the Dutch accent a lot at home, but I won't do that online. So, what can we get you to drink, gentlemen?
Oh yeah, so like I already told you, this is very boring. It's like it's a pint of water or
It's not vodka, is it? It looks like vodka, but
yeah, no, this is
either
not
way, whatever is in
a
there, we don't judge. We're a
Exactly.
non-judgmental social distance inn. And Christian?
Yeah, I'll have a ginger beer. Actually, I
Ginger
got one that says that it's from England, but I think that's just the marketing department that decided that. But it's a good ginger beer, so
Very good. Very
I do
good.
like
Paul?
beer, but this is different for once.
That's all right. I've gone fairly standard stock cider today, Jeff. First one I pulled out the fridge, a can of Stoford Press.
Yeah, the old faithful.
I do like a Stoford, served in my local pub, Herefordshire cider. Tastes like apples, Jeff.
Well, okay. Well, I'm not going standard.
Oh.
I'm going for homemade, the engineer's dark side.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, this is a home brew. It's a 6% dark ale
Wow.
made by myself. I haven't opened it yet. This is the first one I've opened. So, yeah, it didn't explode. That's a good start. I'll pour it so you can see what
Very
it is.
curious to hear what it tastes like.
It's
Very
very
dark.
dark. Very, very
Oh,
dark.
wow. It is.
It's like stout.
Yes. So this, well, it looks like it. It shouldn't taste like it, but we'll see. It's got Boadicea hops in it, but it should be dark. It should have some kind of vanilla flavor, apparently, but we'll see.
Ooh.
It does have a slight sweet taste
We're
to
all
it.
jealous now for not being it.
Yeah, it's nothing like a stout. It's room temperature, obviously. That's where I've kept it, but it is. It's quite. It has a te sort of texture of an ale rather than a stout. It's not very thick, and yeah, it has a little bit of a nice woody taste to it, and it doesn't taste 6%. So
That's
that'll go quite nicely.
yeah.
Yeah.
So do you follow a recipe with this stuff, Jeff, or are you kind of making it up as you go along?
Both. So I haven't yet got into making my own malts. So
Right.
I will get my own malt from a shop, but I will mess around with hops.
Okay.
And I tried different sugars as well. So this I actually put brown sugar in rather than white glucose.
Yeah, which gives
Mainly
it that
because
darker
I
color.
lost the glucose. I don't know where it went. So it was kind of an innovation, improvisation through necessity, but yeah, it worked absolutely fine. So that's nice. I was a little bit, I didn't know how this one was going to turn out, so I'm
Oh,
pleased with
wow.
that. Very good.
And where can I or listeners get it if we want to order it? Is it available somewhere?
Well, I don't have a license to sell alcohol, so I can't do that. But I have been known to give out gifts to
Right.
people, so you never know. With Christmas coming up.
So, Christian, given your enthusiasm about beer, is brewing your own beer on your bucket list as well, or?
I would love to, but I don't. You have to be super clean, and I always respect people who are able to pull it off, especially a beer like you just described, Jeff. From what I've heard, that's very hard to get right taste-wise. So, I would love to, but too hard for me, I think. I'm not clean enough for it.
Sterilizing agent. Did you underestimate how much sterilizer you need?
Like buckets full.
Yeah, you have to keep cleaning stuff, don't you? Everything has to be spotless, doesn't it? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, so that's whenever I go into the local shop that sells the homebrew kits, he always says, "And have you got enough sterilizer?" Something he says every time to everybody. I've currently got two buckets of the stuff, but yeah, it's nice to be clean, but especially if you're going to be offering it to other people.
Sure. Yeah.
But I'd encourage you to give it a go. I think it's a good, especially if you're doing it yourself. It's an inspect and adapt thing, right?
It is. Try it. I may dabble with it at one point because a lot of friends of mine are doing it too. So
another thing I've been experimenting with recently, actually, but I don't know whether this translates. Scotch eggs.
What is that?
What is a Scotch egg? Paul knows what Scotch egg. It's in England. It's quite a good pub snack, really. Basically, it's a boiled egg, and then there's a coating of sausage meat. And then a coating of breadcrumbs.
Oh, wow.
Which is deep fried, I believe, isn't it?
And it is deep fried, but then baked as well. So I've been experimenting with this. So I've made some chorizo Scotch eggs, and I've been using different types of breadcrumbs, panko breadcrumbs and things. Just trying lots of different things and experimenting and getting some feedback. And yeah.
I get the impression, Jeff, you're actually running a pub, and you're just not telling me. You've diversified, and you're actually that shed that you're in now is actually a fully licensed bar.
Well, I think it's good to have options.
Oh, diversify your portfolio.
But we should properly introduce our guests, Barry and Christian, who we will explore why, but are known as the liberators from Holland, the Netherlands, Dutchland, as Paul calls it.
No, I don't. Make it up.
So I've known Barry for a while, Christian for not quite as long. Through various means of the liberating structures that they promote, the Zombie Sun Survival Guide, what used to be called the Scrum Team Survey, but it's now called something else. Or have I got that the wrong way around?
It's now the Scrum Team Survey, and it was the Zombie Scrum Survey. Yeah,
got you. And also, Barry and I collaborated a few years ago with regards to curriculum between Scrum Alliance and Scrum.org around the Advanced Scrum Master Certification. So we've known each other for quite a while, but welcome. Thank you for joining us.
We're super glad to be here. It's a pleasure.
And I guess that would be a good place to start. Why do you call yourself the Liberators?
Well, you came up with the name, so...
It's his fault.
No, it's a great name, but it was very hard to come up with a name, and Barry had it all of a sudden.
Yeah, we didn't want to have something boring like this cliche name. So we're looking for something that already sets the expectation, sets the tone about if an organization or a team starts to collaborate with us, what they can expect. I think the liberators, I'm not sure. Yeah, it also describes what we want to achieve, like liberate teams, liberate organizations from outdated modes of working, outdated modes of collaborating with each other. And liberate them in such a way that they can unleash their superpowers. And we believe that each team has superpowers that need to be brought to the surface. And for some teams, it's quite easy. You just need to scratch the surface and you'll see superpowers appear. Well, and some teams, you need to do a bit more work. They were able to hide them quite well.
And how long have you and Christian been working together? How long has this partnership been in place?
I think, Chris, 4 years now, 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and we started the Liberators 3 years ago. So and a year before that, we were just working together as freelancers. Barry started as a freelancer. I'd already been freelancing for a few years. And we sort of connected because we have a similar style of writing. I think we connected mostly on the writing, on the blogging. And from there on, we started working together. It was a lot of fun. And it still is, by the way. Yeah, important to mention that.
Yeah. So teams need liberate. Are they prisoners then? Are teams captive in your experience more often than not?
I think we both think so. And I won't say most teams, but sometimes what we always like to do is when we enter an organization or visit it or talk to people from an organization, sort of to get a sense of what are the things that you're smelling when you go into the office building or into the team room.
And that's not literal, right? Because we've used the term scrum smells before. That those things that just don't seem quite right. But you're not actually talking about what how things actually smell, right?
No, not literal smells, but more like what are the cultural smells or the things that people say or the sense that you're getting of being somewhere. And one thing we've both noticed is that there are so many organizations where you have all these smells that radiate low autonomy. People don't feel like they control anything, like they own anything. They're just doing what they're told. And well, for Barry and me, our background has always been that we worked for organizations where we had a lot of control and a lot of autonomy. And in a sense, we do want to help those teams experience that same level of autonomy as we've done in the past.
Yeah.
So I think we want to liberate teams, and many teams can use some help there.
Well, Chris, I do recall an experience that we had at an organization whose name I will not draw in this session, but when we entered the building, they gave us a, I'm not sure what the name is, something to remove dust.
A duster.
And it was the department that gave it to us, because it was more like a symbol that they wanted to have every employee a duster so they could revitalize their own organization.
Okay.
That was an interesting experience for us. Like, okay, there's some work to do over here.
I'm sure it was Baz Vodder that used to put on his business card something like Agile Janitor or something like that, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm sure it was Baz that used to say that.
Yeah.
You got a lot of similar smells. Like, I also remember the company with all the dead flowers everywhere, you know, and in the team room and the welcome area, there were all these dead plants. And that's always sort of, it's just a small thing, but it's still something that you notice.
Can't keep basic things alive. Yeah, it just tells you something.
Yeah, I think so.
So what was the connection with the liberators? Was it accidental with the liberating structures, or was that deliberate?
Barry, you want to take this one, or shall I do it?
Yeah, but I'm actually not sure if it was accidental. I think it was accidental. But I think we were quite happy that once we came up with the name The Liberators, at that time we already used liberating structures.
Yeah,
I think it was more like an extra benefit that it's quite easy that the connection with liberating structures is easy to make. And sometimes people approach us because they think that we created liberating structures. I think sometimes we have done a bit too much promotion and created too much content about liberating structures. But just to also to clarify that one, we did not. Henry Lepmanovich and Keith McCandles, those two awesome people, they co-created and co-developed liberating structures. And we're just two humble guys from the Netherlands that learned a lot from them and are just very passionate and enthusiastic about it.
Yeah.
Have you worked with them? We still do,
by the way, which is incredibly awesome because Keith and Henry have so much experience and it's always a pleasure to talk with them and to chat with them. We've done immersion workshops with them, like about liberating structures, but also we hang out with them every now and then on Zoom. More with Henry at the moment, but with Keith also every now and then. It's always a lot of fun. But yeah, I think the name was accidental, sort of the connection with the name was accidental, but it was also because we were doing a lot with liberating structures at the time. Yeah, but it's sometimes a bit confusing for people, to be honest. So,
I think it's very good. And I think that was I certainly put those two together straight away, thinking when I think of, for right or for wrong reasons, when I hear about liberating structures, and I generally make that association with the two of you straight away, which is obviously great, working well. So, yeah, keep doing it.
What are Keith and Henry's backgrounds? They're not agile people, are they? Where do they come from?
Keith has a background in complexity science. I think he was part of the Plexus Institute in the United States. That's also, by the way, where he met Henry. And the Plexus Institute is specialized in complexity science. So a lot of people in that field were part of that institute or working for it. And Henry Lepmanovich was one of the, I think he was a VP for, what's it called? A big pharmaceutical in the United States. But I can't remember the name.
Yeah.
Merck. Yeah, he was a VP for Merck. He actually discovered, he noticed there that every time there was a meeting, it lacked energy, people were not engaged. And he wanted to change it, but he didn't know how. And that's when Keith and Henry met. And Keith was already working with this idea for liberating structures. And Henry thought, let's try it at Merck. And that's what they did, I think, 30 years ago or 25 years ago. And from there, they actually started developing liberating structures. So there's quite a rich history, actually, of both those two, but also liberating structures.
It's also interesting that within the Plexus Institute, that's also where the Kinefin framework was developed, so to say. So it's all connected in a way.
But
Henry and Keith have zero background with Agile, with Scrum. And when Chris and I met them, they were pretty overwhelmed with that there's this entire community out there as well. And I think what Chris and I did, and also, of course, not only us, but also other people, is that made the connection with Scrum and liberating structures, because we think that the connection makes a lot of sense, and that you can get way more efficient with Scrum and all the Scrum events, etc., if you connect them with liberating structures.
Mm-hmm. So I haven't studied the evolution of it, but it has evolved, right? These practices, the 33 or 4, however many there are at the moment, they've evolved over time. And my instinct tells me that it's been kind of a symbiotic relationship, the Agile world and the liberating structures world, because you see things like open space in there, you see things like effectively pairing in there, right? The Troika consult, that kind of thing. 1, 2, 4, these things, I don't think they've necessarily come from one space or another. It's been that emergence.
So at the risk of slowing down a bit, Jeff, apologies for that. Is it worth, for maybe some of our listeners that perhaps haven't heard of liberating structures before, Barry, and Christian, can you give us a brief kind of synopsis? What is a liberating structure, and what would it be used for?
Well, Chris, this is something that you can do, because I'm terrible explaining liberating structures. I think that's also the most difficult thing. So if Christian is going to pull him off, then I have huge respect for him, because liberating structures really is something that you should experience. Okay. It's like talking about liberating structures is about Jeff showing his beer. And then you're like, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good example.
Got it. Okay.
Tastes very good.
Oh, so, Chris, yes.
Yeah, well, you set the expectations. Well, I think we always like to describe liberating structures as the antidote to what you normally see when you put a group of people together in a meeting room. Normally, you have people sitting around a table, and then one person talks for a very long time, everyone else listens, or not even. And then another person starts talking for a very long time, but you don't hear anyone else talking during the meeting. And liberating structures are very simple alternative ways of organizing interactions between a group of people in such a way that all their voices can actually be included in the conversation. And there are many liberating structures, 33 in total, and each structure does this in a different way, but with a very specific purpose. So, for example, you have the liberating structure 1, 2, for all. And Barry, would you be able to explain the steps of 1, 2, for all? Because then we can sort of explain it together.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so 1, 2, for all is one of the basic foundational liberating structures. Its simplicity is also its strength, because a 1, 2, for all is one is 1 minute individually. So you give a group of people an invitation, something to think about, and then they take 1 minute individually to get their thinking started. Afterwards, they form pairs. And then as a pair, they have a conversation about the same invitation for 2 minutes. And then that pair goes on a double date and forms a group of four. And then as a group of four, they develop new ideas together. And then the all part, that's the part where, if necessary, then they can share some of the insights that stand out the most with the group as a whole. So you really scale up conversations in such a way, but in such a way that everyone has had time to contribute and to get their own thinking started as well.
Mm-hmm.
And what you could do is, sometimes we explain individual liberating structures as Lego bricks. So one liberating structure is a Lego brick, and one Lego brick is already pretty cool. But the real magic happens when you start connecting all these Lego bricks to each other, and then the possibilities are endless. So the real strength of liberating structures becomes visible when you start creating strings of liberating structures.
Got it. Okay.
So for the meeting, the workshop, the gathering, your birthday party, whatever, take something in mind. Try to identify the purpose that you want to achieve with it, and then start playing with all these Lego bricks, aka liberating structures, and try to create a string by which you can achieve that purpose. And that's very cool. And that's became sort of the hobby of Christian and myself as well.
And have you each got a favorite?
Like, I've got 33 favorites.
Yeah. Is that okay? You wouldn't let a product owner get away with that, would you? You wouldn't let a product owner get away with that.
I've got a couple of them. Shall I start, Chris?
Sure, go ahead.
Let me think. Critical uncertainties, without any doubt. So critical uncertainties is about strategy making, creating strategies together with the entire group. And maybe to make a connection with Scrum, you can use critical uncertainties to create a product strategy. And then not one strategy, but based on critical and uncertain things that might happen, you create multiple strategies. So that if one of these scenarios becomes a reality, then you already prepared yourself for that happening, and then everyone knows what to do.
That's it. You're only getting one.
Yeah, you only get one. Yeah. I agree.
Okay, that's it.
Yeah, my Chris. Favorite would be appreciative interviews. It's a very simple structure. Basically, everyone finds another partner, and they share a success story of something that went really well for them personally with one other person. That other person then gets time to also share their story, but they also have to listen carefully to each other and make some notes about what was that success story and what made it possible, because in the next round they actually have to retell the success story of their partner to two other people from another pair that joins them. And then in that group of four, the question is, if you've listened to all these success stories retold by the partners, what are the factors that are common to all of those stories? And how can we invest as a group in those factors right here, right now, to make more of those successes possible? And I think that there's just so much good positive psychology going on in that structure. It's also one of those things you have to experience appreciative interviews to see how well it works. People are always smiling. It feels very good to share a success story. It feels even better to hear someone retell your story in their words. Everyone's always a bit nervous. Did I say all the right things? Did I repeat it correctly? But everyone's always very positive, and the insights that come out of this are always useful. It's a very powerful one.
Yeah.
Do you think some of these can be some of these are more deliberate than others? And what I mean by that is that some might be more formally facilitated, but some of those liberating structures you can almost weave in without people appreciating what you're doing. Is that fair?
I think so, yeah. I think that, I wouldn't say necessarily that they're not all of them are just as deliberate, because all structures have a very clear purpose. Okay. But what we like to do, Barry and I, and we didn't do this initially, is you can do liberating structures without even mentioning it, without even saying what you're doing right now. Okay. Of course, you have to facilitate it, but you can still do appreciative interviews without mentioning that that's what you're doing. And I think that that makes it even more powerful. Mm. We did a lot of that in the past where we actually explained, we're going to do liberating structures, we're going to do this and that. But that can also create resistance in groups that are like, why should we do all these things? What are all these fancy words that you're using all of a sudden? Right. So that's my experience. And Barry, I'm curious, what do you think of this?
Yeah, liberating structures should never be about liberating structures themselves. So I think the only time when we do mention it is during these liberating structures immersion workshops, because that's the purpose of those workshops. But otherwise, we don't really emphasize it. It's more like, let people just experience a liberating structure. And if they're curious about what just happened, then we might give a brief explanation about the structure that we've used. Sure. But the pitfall is always to emphasize it too much, and also to be too strict in time boxing and explaining the steps, etc. It should be more like help the group
just work naturally, certain flow.
And
we had a conversation yesterday, Barry, didn't we, on a similar vein, just about Scrum in general, Agile in general. Just it's you don't need to mention Scrum, you don't need to mention Agile, any of those tools. You just do some stuff in a facilitated way.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's going, like you said, Christian, it's going to be less resistance. There's less need to worry about, oh, this is a thing. This is a mm-hmm. technique that someone's trying to. No. We're just going to have a facilitate this. That's what it is.
And then it works. Yeah. May I ask, Geoff and Paul, what is your experience? What did you experience when you participated in a liberating structure? What was it like for you?
Well, so it's funny. So I was saying to Paul only recently that liberating structures is something that we came across when we did a lot of research into facilitation and collaboration quite a long time ago. And it was something that was one of those things that came in, and probably little bits of it seeded into things that we did. And then we probably didn't pay enough detailed attention to a lot of the stuff, and then it came back into our conscience. So things like 1-2-4-all, things like fishbowl, things like that, the Troika Consulting, they formed part of our facilitation without us really, probably, if I'm being honest, giving the credit where it's due. But this actually wasn't your question, was it? But I was thinking it was only fair, seeing as I asked you your favourite, what my favourite would be. I think my favourite would be 15% solutions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the part of Scrum that I was brought up on that doesn't really seem to get spoken about enough, in my opinion, these days, is the art of the possible. So I was always taught that is effectively what Scrum is. It's the art of the possible. I know inspect and adapt loop and things like that, but for me, don't get caught up in what things should be. Focus on what things could be. And that fits very nicely with the other world that I operate in professional coaching, which is just make some progress. Forget about the things that you can't control. Focus on what you can control.
Right. Yeah.
85% of it, fine. You can't affect that, all right? But you can affect the 15. Let's focus on that. Mm-hmm. And I think it works for product owners. I think it works for development teams. I think it works for Scrum Masters. I think it works for leaders. Anyone involved, I think just that 15% just gets that momentum, that ball rolling.
I like that. I like that a lot. And I fully agree with it. 15% solutions is awesome. And we almost always do it at the end or even halfway when we do a workshop with teams. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Maybe one thing to mention, and then Paul, I'm going to give it to you. So one thing to mention, that's also the hope that Christian and I have. And I think Christian actually wrote a blog post about it, which is called, top of my mind, liberating structures are not techniques for facilitators, but for users, something like that. My hope is, and that's also a pitfall that we see, is that liberating structures are being perceived as something for facilitators and trainers, things that you only use during training and workshops, and that's it. While the intention is that everywhere where more than two or three people collaborate with each other, interact with each other, they benefit from using liberating structures.
Mm-hmm.
So just in regular day-to-day conversations, you can already use impromptu networking, you can already use 1-2-4-all, etc. My encouragement, especially to people listening to this one, is just think about any kind of conversation that you'll have today, tomorrow, next week, and just try one or two liberating structures and just go for the basic ones. Because I'm quite sure that once you've tried the basic ones, you'll be addicted as well, and then you'll start exploring the other ones.
I think a lot of people actually find that they've used some of them already, or certainly been involved with some of them. They're not crazy magic,
not at all. Dark
magic or anything, are they? They're relatively normal ways of working.
Yeah,
they're simple. They're also intended to be so simple that anyone can use them. You don't need to get a license for it or a certificate or go to a very advanced training of any kind. You just read the website. It helps if you experience it once or twice with other people, and then you can do it. Maybe not the super, the more difficult ones like critical uncertainties that needs some practice, but it's still not incredibly hard to do. So it's easy. Just give it a try.
Yeah.
And for you, Paul, what was your favorite one?
Yeah, well, I think like Geoff said, we've kind of riffed on a few of these in the past, probably without giving them their full credit where credit's due. But I'd probably say the what, so what, now what, I think is probably that's we've used that as a debrief quite a lot in our exercises and it always goes down well, because it's like you say, it's just so simple. It's really easy to introduce, and it's really easy to do debrief, because they're just three simple questions. And the other one, which again, I've always experimented with the five wise, but I like the idea. It's nine wise, isn't it? But basically, you go that stage further again. You keep, which can be extremely frustrating for people that you're asking those questions to. Yeah. But yeah, you're basically imitating a small 6 year old child and just keep asking why until you get the answer, until you get reach the bottom. Yeah, so yeah, they're probably the ones that I use the most often, I think.
Really fair that you were able to pick to choose two.
Yes, see? Yes, I'm just a bad product owner.
Okay, it's fine.
Well, it's nice that you mentioned product owners. Well, it makes a lot of sense with the both of you, but especially for product owners, they're so useful to do with stakeholders. Mm. And it's not happening nearly as much as we hope it would be, because what we are seeing, and maybe you have a different perception, but it's mostly Scrum Masters doing it, sort of in a way, the facilitators. But I would love to see far more product owners do something with liberating structures. And all the power to them. It would be great.
Use min specs to have a critical look at your product backlog and see what's left after you've used min specs.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? What in terms of the exposure, is it mainly, like you said, Barry, because it's been seen as this facilitation toolkit? Do we need to change our tack with that? Do we need to push it in a different direction to get more product owners involved, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm not sure, actually, why that is. It could also just be because, in general, maybe Scrum Masters, Agile coaches, facilitators might be just, more... For them, it might be more convenient to try this kind of stuff. It could also be that product owners are interested, but then they give their Scrum Master a call and say, hey, have a look at this and let me know if it's...
Read that and let me know if it applies.
I have a theory.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
And that is that since the role of the Scrum Master was brought in, facilitation was an explicit part of the role. But the product owner has always been associated with product management. That word management, and one of the critical parts of a job description for product managers, and I think it's also been adopted largely for product owners as well, is stakeholder management. That term, stakeholder management. But when I'm coaching product owners, I don't talk about stakeholder management as such. I talk about stakeholder facilitation. And I think that difference of emphasis is important, because the Scrum Master is facilitating people because they don't have authority. Now, the product owner has some level of authority, but quite often they don't have authority over the stakeholders. They need to facilitate them. And that phrase, herding chickens is or herding cats, mm-hmm. is chaos, right? And that those facilitation skills to be able to, and a lot of these techniques, as you said, Chris, will help massively in facilitating that group. That's my theory anyway.
Mm.
Yeah, there is a package going to be delivered in a minute, by the way, so I have to zoom out and open the doors. So I'll mute for a moment and be back in a minute.
No worries.
I'm just going to Google that well-known phrase, herding chicken.
Sorry.
Well, that will make the bloopers real, Jeff. Yes, don't you worry about that.
So now we have 2 minutes to talk about Chris. So.
Well.
you can tell us all the secrets now.
Well, one of the interesting conversations that we have with people in this series is inspirations. So we started this track really in response to the fact that it was 20 years since the Agile Manifesto, and how things have progressed over the last 20 years since that event. And the people that we've been talking to that we've considered in various different ways to be inspirations to us, but also largely the community. How have you seen? Well, I guess there's two questions, so I'll prioritize. First of all, who are your inspirations as you were getting involved in the Agile world and over the last 20 years or so?
Mm. Well, shall I go first, Chris?
Sure, go ahead.
So I think I'm going to mention Henry and Keith once more, but for a different reason. I think they, when I had a conversation with them a couple of years ago, they mentioned that they moved into the direction of developing liberating structures because they were a bit tired about all these frameworks and methodologies that were going on, also in their field of work. That's something that I could really relate to, because liberating structures doesn't tell you anything about what framework or methodology to use. I'm still enthusiastic about Scrum. I'm connected to Scrum.org as a Scrum trainer, doing quite a lot of work with Scrum. But for me, it's never about Scrum. So I use Scrum from an agnostic perspective as well. So probably will hardly ever hear me talk about Scrum from a theoretical point of view, because that's quite boring. You can read it in a Scrum guide and then you'll just end up in a theoretical discussion that sounds interesting, but is pretty useless. So I always try to stay away from that, from Scrum as a framework, and more on a deeper level, talk about empiricism, how it ties back to complexity, how it can help you with product delivery. And whenever we talk about Kanban, Agile, extreme programming, Lean, well, it's all fine by me. But again, I'm also trying not to talk about Kanban itself, but again, so what does it make possible? So for me, the inspiration was to have a confirmation in what I already had in mind and just to strengthen it.
Such a good answer. Only plus one that, by the way. I would have also said Henry and Keith, maybe even more Henry because he's a bit older. He's really a senior citizen. I don't know his actual age, into the 80s or end 70s, but the way he is still engaging with professionals like us, that's just incredible. When I have that age, I want to do that too, you know, just to be so engaged still with your work and what it makes possible. But also a lot of the people that inspired me when I started with Scrum were not so much thought leaders or anything, but more like, for example, the owner of the company where I worked at the time, who was willing to give the teams that I was also a part of a large degree of autonomy to make their own decisions, which was risky because the products we were creating were quite, it was important that they were of high quality, but he still gave us autonomy. And I think that that's still an inspiration to me in how you can lead a company and how different leadership often looks like in most companies. I'm very spoiled in a sense by having worked for a company where I saw a good example of this. But for me, the entrepreneurs, the business owners that do that, that make those kinds of decisions, they are still very inspirational to me even now.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I want to amplify that if I can, because it is easy for us as trainers, coaches, podcasters, whatever we consider ourselves to be, to say, you know, if you're running a business, then give your teams autonomy. You know, mm-hmm. inspect, make mistakes, you know, try something, get to market, fail, we can say all that stuff. But actually, when your money's on the line, when you're, you know, you're a director of a company, you've got customers, this is your baby, this is your life, actually doing that, taking that gamble, trusting those people, and giving those people the space to be themselves, and that is tough, and that will inspire more people deeper than any thought leader, like you say, or author or signatory of the manifesto. Not to put them down at all, but the people are actually doing the business. I think that is a massive point.
Yeah, that have skin in the game if it goes wrong. And thought leaders can still contribute a hell of a lot to our community, but sometimes it's easy to say something that sounds good, but you don't have any skin in the game.
Yeah.
But these are the people that are investing their money, sometimes their own money. And I think that that's, and Barry, you also worked for a company where that was the case, right?
Yeah, it was the same. And also, again, luckily a positive experience where I started experimenting with Scrum at a web agency. I think it's already like 8-9 years ago. But that organization also made the jump towards autonomous teams. And I was also able to see like the impact on the owner and what kind of courage it took to make that decision. And especially just to let go of control. Because like you said, Jeff, it's for us, it's quite easy to say, just do it because I read in a lot of articles that it seems to be a good idea. So let's just give it a try. But if it's your own company and it can also, it can become a success, but it can also go the other way around. But luckily, I've also had more positive than negative experiences on that area.
Where do you see it? What's the next step? Do you think is the next leap within the agile industry? Where do we need to go next? Where do we need to focus?
I can make a very poor connection to the Scrum Team Survey, like the entire world. is that okay?
If you have data, right?
Yeah.
What's your data telling you?
Maybe Chris, can you talk about that a bit of like the research?
Well, maybe just a step back is that our hope for where we are going with our community is to be more evidence-based, to whenever we decide to do something, like apply a certain practice or even implement Scrum or something else, look at the evidence. What does the evidence actually say when we talk about fluid teams? What does the evidence actually say? I think what in our community, a lot of the things we do are informed by opinion, are informed by what thought leaders say, which can be very true, but it can also be not true, and it can also cause damage. And I think that what would be really good is if in our community we use more existing evidence, scientific evidence, data, evidence from data, and also evidence from personal experience, but that should be just one part of it. And that would be perfect and awesome. And I think that that's what we're trying to do also in a small part with the Scrum Team Survey.
Well, that I'm glad you brought that up, because I know you've got a big passion for that, and it's something that Paul and I, we touched on in a podcast quite a while ago when we were in Dublin. Paul, I can remember this one because it's something I've always wanted to come back to.
Probably because it was in Dublin.
It was another dark ale. But yeah, it was just the idea that as a community, as an industry, we need to become a lot more properly scientific. You know, a lot more diligent and. Careful and mindful about the experiments we run, because you said about, yeah, it may well be opinions that inform our decisions, but also things that we see as facts but actually are influenced by our cognitive biases or things that we want to see. We're so good at deluding ourselves as human beings and seeing what we think should be there or expect to be there. And if we hold something as passionately as a lot of us do in this industry, you know, we believe that self-organizing teams are the right thing to do, well, then we will see evidence for that and we will filter our evidence against that. But in what conditions? I think it's really, we do need to get a lot better at that.
I think that's a really good point. The confirmation bias, it's so easy to fall into. and we fall into it all the time too. But fortunately, there is a lot of research that we can rely on. There is a whole lot of scientific research into agile teams, into Scrum teams, into different practices. But for some reason, our community and the academic community that are both working on this area, they don't know how to find each other. And there are connections being made, fortunately, but they're still far and few between. So it would be great if we have way more of this.
In order for us to do that, one of the things that I've seen, I tend to find either you get a lot of data that says positive things or a lot of data that says negative things. And trying to get the two perspectives together and being able to, you know, rationally and objectively evaluate the different perspectives, not hear two sides of the story, which is often what's put, but rationally, objectively evaluate all aspects of situations. And try and take the emotion out of it as much as possible. Look for patterns, look for connections, but also strip out, you know, what appears to be correlation, but it, you know, or causality, but actually isn't. That we talk about it, but I don't think we've got the skills in the industry, the discipline, the rigor.
I agree. Not yet. I hope that's going to change. And we can work on this, the four of us and others who are listening to this can work on this too. But yeah, totally agree with that.
And maybe just one extra hope that I have. It's more like a yes and. So yes and more evidence-based work that we're doing, and also a better connection with the science that's available. And maybe new research that we can do. An extra hope is that it also results in practices, experiments, strategies that the teams themselves can use to create an environment where they can be successful. So that the teams are put in a position that they have the self-managing capabilities to do something with the scientific findings, that they have the autonomy and they don't have all these dependencies in their own organization. And I think as a community, as a whole, we can also do better in that area, because I always find it a bit strange that within our community, everyone is preaching about autonomous teams, self-organizing, self-managing, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's often this dependency like, well, you do need me as the expert to make it work in your own organization. While I believe that teams are perfectly fine to experiment for themselves what works in their own context. So just hope that as a community, we can also move more in that direction.
I had to explain to my 10-year-old what the other day what a fad was, and a fad, again, I'm not sure if that translates well into Dutch, but basically, my wife described my work as a fad, and I said, "Well, that fad has been around for 20 years now, my love." So
it's a real fad.
So yeah, and I had to explain to my 10-year-old what it meant. But I on that point, I wonder if now it is 20 years, of course, since the manifesto was signed and created, but that event, that passion from a personal point of view has got us this far. But I think you're right that it has to be backed up now, and it has to be a lot more scientific, it has to be a lot more evidence-based, and it has to be proven. I think people are looking to prove or disprove those results within their own context, and you can't do that just by telling people that they should do it.
Well, Chris, you've actually done this, haven't you? You've done studies, and a lot of people will have run tests, but an experiment is different to a test, right? Mm-hmm. So, what would you recommend anybody, if you could give them some advice to make their tests more scientifically valuable or empirically valuable? What would the advice be?
That's such a good question. I think there are two ways to go about this. It kind of depends on what you're trying to test. So for example, if you're interested in testing, I don't know, is estimation a good technique to use in our organization or not? Then there is a lot of existing research that you can just read and investigate and draw conclusions from. So you don't have to necessarily do that yourself, I think. You can rely on really good high quality evidence that's already there. If it's more about, for example, certain features in your product, more product-oriented testing that you're doing, I think it's always really important to have a control scenario where you don't change anything and that you have a scenario where you actually enable a feature or disable it or make it different or change it in one way or another. And then at least for a while, measure as objectively as you can how that's impacting the users of your product. Yeah. And then you can actually compare it. Usefully, it's not a perfect experiment because doing a perfect experiment is hard even in a controlled scientific environment. But I think this already takes out a lot of bias that could be in there. I think it's also important to learn at least some basic statistical techniques, not just compare numbers, but that you know what significance is and how you can calculate that. It's not hard. You just have to know how to do this. I think that that would also be very helpful for people to know a bit more about.
Yeah. So I don't necessarily think everybody needs to go back to school and learn statistics. But I think just the basic premise of control variables, dependent variables, independent variables, statistical significance, sample size, confirmation bias, survivorship bias, those factors, if you can build those into what you're doing, things will be better. And I think that would be more than 15%. Going back to our 15% solutions, that would be more than 15%. And we would be better off as a result.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And maybe to add to this, one thing that I've been thinking about recently is, and actually talking about with a few people as well, is it would be nice if for our community, there would be an easier way to learn about scientific methodology. And I don't mean necessarily all the details, but like what is actually an experiment? What is a controlled experiment? What is a case study? What's the difference? So that you can also determine what method you need to test your hypotheses that you have about your product. I think that learning a few of those skills would at least be helpful.
I think you're the perfect person to submit something like that to an upcoming conference, Chris.
Yeah, maybe I should. Let me think about it. It would be cool. Yeah.
Cool. Just reintroduce the liberating structures aspect. And I was interested really on how some of those things, because obviously you mentioned you do some immersion workshops where you go through those techniques. Has the remote working element changed or not changed, but perhaps surfaced some of those structures that work better for perhaps a lot of teams? Many teams won't have gone back to face-to-face in-person workspaces yet. Is there anything that you found works really well that's easy to do online?
I think for the past 2 years, I've done quite a lot of experiments with using liberating structures online. It is different. I think you cannot you can compare it, but different using liberating structures online is different than using the same liberating structures face to face.
Could you give us an example?
Well, a lot of liberating structures have to do with body language, with the way people are sitting in a small group, the way people walk around, the way people use the physical space, so to say. So body language, physical space, that makes or breaks a liberating structure. That's completely different in an online setting. And it also makes it more difficult for some structures, because some structures can become more mechanical, because then, well, if you take all of that away, what's left is the invitation or the topic that people have a conversation about. And yeah, it can still work. So I am convinced that if you do something online, liberating structures help you make the most out of it. Mm-hmm. So it will drastically improve the online experience, especially if you use tools like Zoom or recently Microsoft Teams also has this breakout room option, because then again, you can scale up and down the conversations that you have. And some liberating structures were maybe not better, but are easier. Mm-hmm. Because what we've done is, for example, again, critical uncertainties, if you do it in a face-to-face setting, spotting the patterns across all the ideas that emerge in this exercise, it's quite difficult. With an online whiteboard, you just have to zoom out and then you'll see the patterns. The same goes for eco-cycle planning. It's a lot of fun in a face-to-face setting. In a way, it's just a healthy physical exercise, which requires a lot of walking, etc. But again, online, it's even easier. Just create multiple ecocycles, zoom in and out quickly, and you'll see what's there and what you can learn. So it's, it also has some advantages. But then again, it's different.
Hmm. Yeah, I think we both prefer the in-person version of it, just because the energy in the group is so, it's so cool to feel that energy that happens when people use liberating structures, especially in large groups. But at the same time, during the COVID lockdowns, both Barry and I have been in multiple conversation cafes where we had people from all over the world sitting in conversation cafes, which is one of the liberating structures. And just having that possibility to talk with anyone on the planet about a personal question with a well-structured interaction like conversation cafe, that was pretty cool, I have to say.
Yeah,
it's good stuff. Yeah, very cool. Good.
I know Paul, what Paul's about to say now. He's going to tell me we have to wrap up, Jeff. Paul is my time boxer. He is my timekeeper. He is the one that manages to keep our episodes to a manageable length. Otherwise, I would be here all day.
That's because I've got to edit it, Jeff. I do edit it.
So it is time. And generally, the other time box that I have is that my glass is empty. So that's my other way of my non-clock watching method of time boxing. But again, thank you, both of you, for what you've done, but also for joining us today. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you, chaps.
It was a pleasure. Cheers.
Cheers.